Good afternoon. My name is Linda Southward, and I have the pleasure and honor of directing the Children's Foundation of Mississippi. We are absolutely thrilled to have our guest today, Dr. Michael Rich, who will also be our keynote speaker at our upcoming Children's Foundation of Mississippi 4th Annual Summit to be held February the 13th, 2025. But just as an introduction, Dr. Rich is an associate professor of pediatrics at Harvard Medical School and practices adolescent medicine at Boston's Children's Hospital. He's a pediatrician, child health researcher, father, and filmmaker. Dr. Rich is also the founder and director of the Digital Wellness Lab and the first evidence-based medical program addressing physical, mental, and social health issues associated with digital technology use, the Clinic for Interactive Media and Internet Disorders, and as the Mediatrician, which is the name of his book, The Mediatrician's Guide, A Joyful Approach to Raising Healthy, Smart, Kind Kids in a Screen-Saturated World. We are delighted to have him as our guest in our inaugural podcast session. So, Dr. Rich, welcome.
Thank you. It's a joy to be with you.
We have often heard for many decades that parents are their children's first and best teachers. I want to start with a reading from one of your chapters in the book about the teachable moment. You note that increasingly screen media are children's first and most frequent exposure to many experiences, behaviors, and beliefs. And as children grow older, screens play an increasingly important role in shaping the schemas by which kids organize their experiences. Produced and presented thoughtfully, screen media can help children develop more diverse, flexible, and tolerant schemas, or it can contribute to the narrowing, stiffening, and concretizing of their understanding of themselves in their world. Would you start off and talk a little bit more about these two different ways of looking at the world through social media?
Well, I completely agree that parents are their first and best teachers for children. But we live in a world that is screen saturated. There are screens in virtually every environment we're in. They're in our pockets and on our wrists, and who knows where in the future. But they present a remarkable opportunity for showing all of us, but children in particular who are learning and developing, the way the world is, the larger world, and it gives them an opportunity to see other cultures, other peoples, other ways of life, other religions, etc. And that can be presented in a way that is positive and inclusive of those cultures and helping those children learn them, or as kind of a freak show, if you will, of look how different these people are. So I think that we have to be very careful about how we present and how their children receive these messages. And then it goes back to the parents again, which is co-viewing with the children and showing them things. Fred Rogers is, you know, a perfect epitome of the way that television can be used to embrace, to support, to affirm, to love each other. And, you know, you compare that to some of the entertainment things that are put in front of children's, like Power Rangers and things of that nature, where even though the intention is good, that these guys are superheroes beating up bad guys, all that the kid receives from it is that's one way to relate to other people, is beat up people you don't agree with. So we have to be very, very careful about how we understand it. And we need to co-view with our children, particularly when they're quite young, and have an open dialogue with them, not just when they are toddlers, but right through when they are teenagers, when they are using various aspects of the digital ecosystem to explore their world, to understand their world, and frankly, to create their own persona for the world.
Thank you. And yes, Mr. Rogers just evokes this universal feeling of goodness and kindness. And understanding who your neighbor is as we reflect back on that. And so with social media, the neighborhood has expanded immensely. It's global. And so when you think about the exposure that young children from various platforms and on through the teenage years and young adulthood, et cetera, are exposed to, it really is mind-boggling to think about that. But let's step back a little bit and give us some history, a brief overview of how the Digital Wellness Lab began, because you've been a pediatrician for quite some time now. So what were you seeing in your practice and an interaction that really catapulted you to do this?
Well, the roots of the Digital Wellness Lab actually started before I was a pediatrician. The first 12 years of my professional life, I was a screenwriter and filmmaker in Hollywood and in Japan. I had an early midlife crisis, I guess, because I felt like film was not feeding my soul the way I needed it to. I wanted to be able to change hearts and minds, and it was really just kind of entertainment. So I had my early midlife crisis and went to medical school. And as I came out of medical school into my training as a pediatrician, was about the time when the American Academy of Pediatrics was starting to get really concerned about the effects of then television on children's physical health in terms of obesity and mental health in terms of aggression and violence. And so I was asked by the Academy, since I had this deep experience in media, to help them sort of develop practice policies. And so for about 10 years, I served on a committee looking at this. I was writing practice policy statements to encourage pediatricians to include children's screen exposure as part of their medical histories. But realized as I worked this that there was a real dearth of good scientific research that looked at how we are changed by the screens we use and how we use them, and particularly how children are changed when they are in this more vulnerable, more open, more available time in their lives to have it really direct the trajectories of their lives. And so at around the turn of the millennium, we started doing research to really build out an academic center of excellence that did research, that tried to turn that research into public education, but also education of our clinicians. And how can we integrate that into our practice, which was often seen as kind of a fringe thing. And I've always seen it as an environmental health issue, that these media are around us all the time. It's like the air we breathe. And, you know, over time, people started to realize that it was really having an effect on not just their physical health in terms of obesity and sleep, but certainly their mental health and increasingly their social health, as social interactions moved from in-person to online over time. And one of the audaciously contrarian things that came about in terms of making the lab what it is today is that for a period of time, I was being asked to speak on these panels to national meetings where they would put me and someone from the tech world on the panel and they'd watch us argue. And of course, the tech people would come out and say, well, we're all for internet safety. And I would actually push back and I'd say, you've got to stop talking about internet safety, which would kind of knock them back on their heels and say, what? But we're the good guys. I said, no, but when you talk about internet safety, you presume the internet is unsafe. These children and teens are going to have to live and function and learn and interact on the internet. We can't approach it as, you know, a cesspool. We have to approach it as part of the environment in which they need to function. And yes, there are problems in it, but just as there are problems in our own physical environment, we should address them and change them, but at the same time, learn to live with them because they're not going away instantaneously. And so at one point after one of these meetings, I was in a car going back to the airport with someone from one of the huge tech companies. And she said, Michael, you're so frustrating to talk to because I come in with this great message of internet safety and you keep debunking it and saying I shouldn't talk about that. You have to understand that we are an intensely competitive industry that is intensely secretive and utterly convinced we're the smartest person in the room. This is the one place we can talk to each other instead of, you know, just being behind closed doors and developing our products. And I said, instead of just talking to each other, what if you actually work together? What if you actually work together with people like me to have a second bottom line, which is to take care of those who use your product, to have the health and wellness of your users be another important goal of your strategy. And as a result, we developed this whole idea of instead of waiting until these products were out there and studying them and saying, hey, you're harming kids in this way and that way, to actually do foundational research about the way we interact with screens and how they affect us and feed that simultaneously to the tech companies and to the consumers so that the tech companies would have a heads up of what is healthier and safer and the consumers would know what to ask for and hopefully that market forces will then move the needle towards something better all the time. This is a rapidly evolving environment and we need to stay as close to, shoulder to shoulder with it as we can if we are to help those kids. And we can no longer afford the lag time that exists between our research being published and either them responding or them or legislative bodies like Congress responding by putting the clamps on them. During that period of time, that's 5 years or 6 years. That's a huge amount of time in a child's life. We have to act right now for the kids who are growing up right now.
Right, because for a 10-year-old, 5 years, that's half of their life.
Exactly.
Obviously.
Exactly. Exactly.
But the idea of coming together and making this as much as possible a win-win so that the science is informing the development and safeguards, if you will, if that's the appropriate word to use, of how this is going forward.
Yeah.
So I know that there are parents, and when you were talking about the policy statements with American Academy of Pediatrics, and you have been engaged in that, it's my understanding that pediatricians also have a sort of a guidebook, if you will, as parents come in, some anticipatory guidance sort of questions, depending upon the child's age and where they are developmentally.
Right.
So when you take a look at, let's say, a 6-month-old or an 18-month-old, and parents are very much engaged in, at what point do we have what vaccinations, and when are we can expect them to sleep all night, and then going on from soft foods or better yet, breast milk to foods, etc. So I guess I'm thinking or asking you as an expert on this question, how is it sort of dosed out or parceled out, if you will, to parents as they are coming in to really understand how social media can have an impact, good or bad, on their children and for grandparents? Would you address some of that?
I love the fact that you brought up anticipatory guidance because this is kind of the key to why being a pediatrician is the greatest job in the world, which is that we, for the most part, are managing healthy kids who want to stay healthy. Anticipatory guidance is looking forward into the next few months or the next year as after they finish their current exam, what to expect going forward. And I actually say, in terms of screens and media, I start talking about the earliest stages, not just because of the child's exposure to screens, but because of the parent's exposure to screens that they are monitoring for the child. For example, I think I have an example of this in the book, which is I had a mom who came to me and she couldn't understand. She was having problems breastfeeding and she couldn't understand why her baby had absolutely no problem breastfeeding in the middle of the night when the baby woke her up, and then during the day. And I asked her, well, what does she do at night? She said, well, I stagger over to the crib and I pick up the baby and I'm sort of half awake and I'm in the rocking chair and the baby is nursing and I'm half asleep. And then I put the baby down and everything's cool. And I said, okay, so what do you do during the day? And she said, well, I pick up the baby, I start nursing the baby, and then I pick up my phone and I call mom or I watch the news on the TV or whatever. And he keeps pulling off the nipple. He keeps pulling off. And I said, the most important thing, or maybe the second most important thing to the nutrition, but certainly neck and neck with it, is the baby's gaze. Babies can only see about 10 or 12 inches. And what are they staring at as they suckle? Mom's face. And that is precious, precious time for bonding. And when you are talking on the phone to your mom or watching the television, you're not looking at your baby. And your baby knows that. And she or he is going to be pulling off the nipple and trying to figure out what it is that's got your attention. So I say to them right from the very beginning that media are part of our world. What you do really matters for your child. And in fact, one of the things in the book, as you, I think, know, is what I call the five M's. And the first M is model the behavior with screens that you want to see in your child. And so you don't want to be staring at a screen when your child is staring at you for that love and bonding that's going on.
Exactly. Another thing you have in the book along this line is you have media prescriptions. Instead of having a prescription that's on a pad or sent electronically to a pharmacy, this is something that the parents, grandparents, or childcare providers can really implement in ways that really not it costing perhaps time, which is, as you just mentioned, about the illustration you just gave, but really focusing on this child. So would you talk about how you came about to write prescriptions, if you will?
Very interesting.
The world.
Right. Well, this book is first and foremost a practical guidebook for parents to raising their digital natives. It's very pragmatic. I don't veer off into theory or, you know, hypotheses. It's built on a lot of good science, but basically the job of a pediatrician is to translate complex science into practical action steps for parents that they can do right now. And so that's what the media prescriptions are about, is about various aspects. They're sprinkled throughout the book, and whatever we're talking about, how do you handle a problem? How do you shape your child's media curriculum, for example? Or how do you manage kids who go to someone else's house and are exposed to things you don't want your child to be exposed to, things of that nature? And they're done in very practical ways, but also hopefully in a warm and often humorous way, because after all, the subtitle of this book is A Joyful Approach to Raising Healthy, Smart, Kind Kids in a Screen-Saturated World. This is not about fear-mongering or guilt-inducing and telling parents that they've already messed their kids up. This is really about how to live in this world with them, have some fun, make some mistakes, forgive ourselves, and move on.
Yes. So what sort of changes have you seen in your practice from when you left Hollywood, if you will, to then become a pediatrician and find what you call as the best career around? And we talked about early childhood. Let's just talk about the teen years. how are the prescriptions different there? Or are they different from modeling and mentoring and being a part of a child's interactions? Because as we know, teenagers are different.
Teenagers are different, but the recommendations don't change that much. And I'll tell you why. I mean, let's talk about that first one, model the behavior you want to see in your kids. One of the fairly subversive things I say to my teen patients once their parents are out of the room is, what could your parents do better? Almost always the first thing out of their mouths is, pay more attention to me. They're, you know, the parents are yelling at them to turn off Call of Duty while staring at their own smartphones for that all-important email from the boss or the new recipe on Instagram, whatever. And so I think that we have to understand that our teenagers really care about our attention and really care about us being there for them, even though they seem sullen and non-communicative. You know, what'd you do today? Nothing, right? Sort of thing. Stick with them. And that actually plays into two other M's, particularly as they grow up from children on, which is the first one is mentor, which is to mentor them in the use of each new device or platform or application. And what I'm the reason I use the word mentor instead of teacher is that teachers are kind of a one-way communication. The teacher teaches the student. Mentors learn as much from the mentee as the mentee learns from the mentor. And the parents, interestingly, have said to me many times, parents have said, I dread the internet talk more than I dread the sex talk because I think I know something about sex. I know I don't know enough about the internet. And they don't want to be in that position where their child is teaching them. But mentors relish what they learn from the mentees and vice versa. So when your child wants a smartphone and you feel that she or he is ready for it, sit down and learn it with them. You will learn things. They will know things you don't know, even if you've had a smartphone for a while. And you learn it together in an atmosphere of curiosity, not of judgment or shaming. And that leads into the third M, which is important, which is to monitor, to be able to monitor your child's digital life, not to spy on them, but to be parenting them actively in the digital world where, frankly, they spend as much or more of their waking hours as they do in the physical world or focusing on the physical world. So anyway, you know, what we have to do is with the mentoring, open the door to open conversation about what they're going to encounter on these screens, how they are going to use it. In other words, where they're going to go, where they're not going to go, and also what they think the consequences should be if they go beyond the guardrails. Before they get that phone or that Instagram account or whatever, they'll happily say, oh, take it away from me for a week, this, that, or the other. Once they have that, there's no way you're going to get that back. You're not going to claw that one back. I think it's really important, though, to approach this not as something bad or scary, but as something that is a key responsibility of being a good citizen. Approach this incredibly powerful tool, a tool that is a million times more powerful than the computer that landed Apollo 11 on the moon, and approach it as that, as a power tool. Is my child responsible enough to manage this? Will she use it in ways that help and or harm her? And will she show respect for herself and others in her use of it? And then, as I say, you explicitly talk about what you do, what you don't do, et cetera. And then you see how it goes. But you also have their usernames and their passwords, not to spy on them, but to be present in their world, to monitor their use, to be able to monitor their use, which works interestingly because parents push back really hard against this. You know, of course the kids push back hard. The kids could say, I want my privacy. But the parents push back too because they, I don't have the time to be everywhere she is on social media or everywhere he is when he's gaming. But the fact is that if you can monitor it, they behave differently. And because they know that, should they come across a hate site or pornography or something that disturbs and upsets them, it's not something that they instinctively want to hide from you as if they've been bad, but something that you can work through with them and help them understand it. So model, mentor, and monitor all the way through adolescence.
Yes, and these are so insightful and very pragmatic, as you mentioned earlier, to be a guide for parents and grandparents and teachers, etc. I don't know, and I'm asking you, what would be an appropriate age? I know children, as we said earlier, developmentally are different, but is there like an age of which no cell phone is appropriate?
Of course. Of course.
And I asked that question because also in Mississippi and other places throughout the country, there has been some discussion and some policies on school districts on the use of cell phones within the school day. Not that they are not saying that children or youth can have cell phones, but during the school day, then they are off limits. So I'd love for you to talk some about that, and if you will.
Absolutely. Well, first of all, I can't stand the word ban. Anybody says, I'm going to ban this from you, I'm going to do it. You know, and if I'm going to do it, certainly the adolescents that I take care of are going to do it, right? I mean, it just sparks the rebellion in you. So the approach I take it is the same as we just talked about, which is that these are powerful tools that do many things in amazing ways, you know, can get us to travel around the world in a flash, can, expose us to all kinds of new learnings, some of which are not so good, but many of which are very interesting and good and mind expanding. But let's think about how that tool fits into the main point of a school day, of what school is. School has a twofold role in our children's lives. The first is the didactic learning of math and Spanish and science and literature, whatever. This powerful device is a distraction from that. I've had high school teachers talk to me about their students randomly smiling at their knees in class, right? This is a real issue is around distraction. So that's a problem around class time or instructional time. Some schools say, well, let's ban it for instructional time, but they can have it otherwise. That can actually impinge on what I see as at least as important, if not more important, role of school, which is the social emotional learning. School is the first time young people get to be an individual in a society of their own making. Who do I like? Who do I not like? How do I express that? How do I work that out? How do we do projects? How do I accept challenges? How do I deal with failure? All of these things. If they have a smartphone in their pocket and mom or dad can drop in on them at random intervals all day long, how'd you do on that quiz? Do I need to talk to your teacher? What's going on in the playground or in the lunchroom? And they don't have the opportunity to figure those things out for themselves, to understand how to get along. They've just got mom or dad sitting on their shoulder like Jiminy Cricket on Pinocchio's shoulder, telling them what to do. And they don't get that practical learning of how to get along, how to build a society, and frankly, how to be a citizen. So I see the role of phones in schools as singular, and that is we need to teach them how to use these tools effectively. So we need to teach them how to use them as a research tool, as a navigational tool, and this, that, and the other. We need to have overt teaching of what the phones do, just the way we have overt teaching of computers or of calculators or of crayons, for that matter, but not to let them impinge on these two main foci of an education.
So the more I hear you talk, the more I've read your book. We're so excited about you coming to Mississippi and us having the opportunity to learn from you directly, to have interaction with folks at the summit, etc. But between now and then, would you address, I think you have a newsletter that comes out that's a part of the work that you do, so that parents and teachers and others we've just mentioned can have information even without buying the book. We will, I don't have it a book signing while you're there, but I think what we'll do will really help people want to buy the book and learn more. So talk more about your newsletter and ways people can learn more from you and the Digital Wellness Lab.
Right. Well, the newsletter is just one of a number of resources accessible at digitalwellnesslab.org. And you can, navigate around and see all kinds of, the latest research, questions that you have of various things are often answered. There's also something called the Family Digital Wellness Guide there, which in many ways parallels at least the last part of our book, which is Ages and Stages, a Digital Wellness Primer, which basically looks at the arc of childhood from newborn to early adulthood and the ways that screens interface in positive as well as negative ways with them, and ways one can really enjoy not only your child, but the media you use with them. So there are a lot of resources there that people can pick and choose. I would be delighted to sign books when I come to Mississippi. And as I guess you've detected, talk about it pretty much endlessly, because this is a true passion of mine. I think that this is, while in one way it is the environmental health issue of our time, right up there with climate change, I also think it is our shared human experience. It's the way we share and connect with each other. And as a result, it really matters how we use these tools. We can use social media to compete and put people down and make them feel bad, but we also can use it in ways that are open and vulnerable and respectful.
Yes. Well, one of your, I think it's in that same section of the book, I don't know if it's the exact chapter title, but basically it's an encouragement to the reader, the parent, the teacher, like, yes, you can. It's swirling around, but these are ways that you can break this down and be more engaged with your child. Earlier, you talked about active parenting and learning and having some discussion at the dinner hour, whether that's every night or not, but when there is time for families to get together, for it to be without the presence of social media.
Well, without the presence of any screens.
Yes.
In fact, conversation around the table was the first social media, right?
Well said.
Let's practice basic social media, which is in real life, face-to-face, being with each other.
And as people move away from the family that they grew up with, or not having grandparents next door, I think about the opportunities of having that storytelling and passing on stories and wonderful things that have happened in your family that this generation may very well not know about because of that lack of interaction. So I love the way that you have put so many specific things concrete that parents and readers teachers can avail themselves to. And again, this media prescription to say, yes, we're not going to do all of this week, but we can break it down and we can do what's developmentally appropriate for children.
Yes. And most importantly, have fun with your children. Enjoy your children. And don't hold yourself to be perfect. Don't think that if you're not perfect, you're not a good parent. The reality is none of us is perfect. That doesn't mean we can't keep perfecting ourselves. This is an ongoing work in progress. It always will be. We need to laugh and move on and acknowledge our mistakes, which is another important thing to show and model for our kids.
Absolutely. Well, Dr. Rich, it has just been a tremendous opportunity and delight to have you on our podcast today. And we are so looking forward to your arrival in Mississippi in early February.
As am I. I'm looking forward to meeting everybody, and let's have some fun together.
We will. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.